How early do you have to be there to get a seat?
Because I am what's known as a hard pass holder.
The hardcore.
That's right. I mean, I'll just get there early, around 9, just because I'll want to see the atmosphere and all that.
As the world watches Donald Trump in criminal court in Manhattan, back in Washington, a Supreme Court case is humming along at a much lower frequency. I mean, honestly, practically off the radar. But it has the potential to upend charges for hundreds of January 6 defendants, including the former president. This is The Assignment. I'm Audie Cornish, and I'm here with Joan Biskupic, senior Supreme Court analyst. Hey there, Joan.
Good to see you.
Of course, author of the book, 9 Black Robes, which I have read and is out now on paperback. Congratulations.
Thank you.
All right, so I'm going to try and do what we call the nut graph in journalism, the basics of this case. So once upon a time, there was a former police officer from Pennsylvania. His name was Joseph Fisher, and he decided to go to the January 6th protest, which, of course, turned into a riot. Siege, whatever term people are using at this point. And prosecutors charged him with assaulting a police officer, disorderly conduct, and this is the thing we're going to be talking about today, obstruction of a congressional proceeding. So, why was this particular charge used? It sounds very obvious, but talk to me about this obstruction of a proceeding.
Yes, this charge dates to a 2002 law that was passed in the wake of the Enron accounting scandal. The Justice Department that charged Joseph Fisher felt like it needed to use this particular statute to fully hold him accountable for what he did that day, that specifically went to obstruction of an official proceeding, which, as we know, what was going on January 6th was Congress's attempt to certify the election results from
November.
So this
is what's confusing. You would think that there would be a law about that. Why does it come from an accounting scandal in a case from decades ago where people were basically accused of shredding documents?
Okay, so let me tell you what Congress tried to do in the wake of the Enron accounting practices scandal. They wrote a law that had two provisions that were key to this particular case. And one provision arguably was kind of a catch-all for obstruction of official proceedings of all types. It punishes anyone who, quote, corruptly, and corruptly becomes important, alters or destroys, quote, a record, document, or other object to impair its use in any official proceeding. So the first
in
part—
In any official proceeding.
Exactly.
Okay.
So we've got that. But the important thing here is that first part I just read refers to record, document, essentially tangible evidence. But then it goes on to say it also punishes anyone who, quote, otherwise obstructs, influences, or impedes any official proceeding or attempts to do so. So the question is, are those two parts of the statute read in tandem, or do they constitute two separate provisions that can have two separate charges under them? And Joseph Fisher, who you just referred to, the former Pennsylvania police officer who was part of the mob on January 6th, says it only applies to acts that are tied to records or other evidence.
So he's like, I got to tear something up physically to be an obstruction.
There has to be, yes,
yeah,
some evidence, some record that was spoiled, tainted, otherwise corrupted. But what most of the lower federal court judges who've looked at this have said, no, that part of the provision that follows the word otherwise can apply more broadly to all forms of corrupt obstruction of an official proceeding other than what's mentioned in the first part.
So I'm going to pause here because in oral arguments, of course, this is where the justices get to ask questions.
We will hear argument this morning in case 235572, Fisher versus United States. Mr. Green?
Mr. Chief Justice.
Justice Sotomayor. She said, let's take for an example, there's a sign in a theater that says,
you will be kicked out of the theater if you photograph or record the actors or otherwise disrupt the performance. If you start yelling, I think no one would question that you can be expected to be kicked out under this policy, even though yelling has nothing to do with photograph or recording.
So what she was saying was stick to the plain language. And The otherwise in the language is giving you something different. Now, Justice Gorsuch and his questions and those from other conservatives really showed how they were pulling back and looking at, if you read those phrases separately, you're going to necessarily sweep in lots of other situations.
Would a sit-in that disrupts a trial or access to a federal courthouse qualify? Would a heckler in today's audience qualify, or at the State of the Union address? Would pulling a fire alarm before a vote qualify for 20 years in federal prison?
There are multiple.
So he's using very plain spoken language, I think, for the rest of us to be like, yeah, would it apply here? Would it apply here? How does this make sense?
Exactly. And what Solicitor General Elizabeth Prelogar, representing the U.S. government, trying to keep this prosecution against Joseph Fisher, said, no, though it can be read separately, the key thing, though, is you have to have the intent to corruptly obstruct an official proceeding. And it doesn't necessarily need documents, records, evidence, as long as it's of the most serious nature to obstruct an official proceeding.
So it's the act of obstructing something doesn't necessarily mean it has to be physical paper.
It doesn't have to mean that evidence was torn up. In fact, she talked about situations where someone had essentially obstructed a trial by tipping off some of the witnesses so that it would essentially obstruct the proceeding, but it didn't actually go to the actual physical evidence there. It was the obstruction of the proceeding.
So what I'm hearing from legal experts is that this is kind of novel, a little bit unusual to use this law in this way. And yet over 100 people have actually already been convicted on this charge. So obviously, like, there are some judges out there who are like, yep, seems like it works to me. I mean, how big a deal is it that it reached this point, that it's reached the Supreme Court?
That question is perfect, because that's the question that many justices had. In fact, Justice Clarence Thomas, Chief Justice John Roberts both said, hey, have you really used this law in cases when there wasn't some sort of evidence tampering? And what Solicitor General Prelogar said was, yes, we have. It obviously hasn't been used widely, but she mentioned a couple different instances. And she also stressed that this law, as Congress wrote it, if you focus on the plain English, would cover that, because it says otherwise obstructs, influence, or impedes the official proceeding or attempts to do so. And it was interesting, though, that these more conservative members were saying, if we go more broadly, first of all, we're going to empower the Department of Justice, federal prosecutors,
to go after
a lot of people. And they're worried about Justice Department overreach. Obviously, that's an important consideration.
Yeah. And right now, there are street protests going on, right, about Gaza, et cetera. You don't know sort of where the point of a protest is to disrupt in one way or another, even on January 6th, right? The idea was to disrupt.
Right. And whether that might encroach on First Amendment values. And it wasn't just Neil Gorsuch who raised some of those key examples. Justice Samuel Alito picked up on Justice Gorsuch's question.
So we've had a number of protests in the courtroom. Let's say that today, while you're arguing or Mr. Green is arguing, five people get up one after the other and they shout either keep the January 6th insurrectionists in jail or free the January 6th patriots. And as a result of this, our police officers have to remove them forcibly from the courtroom. And let's say we have to it delays the proceeding for 5 minutes. And I know that experienced advocates like you and Mr. Green are not going to be flustered by that. But, you know, in another case, an advocate might lose his or her train of thought and not provide the best argument. So would that be a violation of 1512C2?
I think it would be difficult for the government to prove that.
Why?
At the outset, we don't think that 1512C2 picks up.
She responded that those kinds of situations that might have minimal disruptive effects, where the Supreme Court could then, you know, resume its oral arguments pretty quickly, are not what this was intended for.
Yeah.
Exactly.
These arguments were actually really interesting, because in New York, you have a case that's being called an election interference case, right? But right there in the Supreme Court, they were finally having a conversation about what did it mean to interfere on that day, on January 6th? And what should it mean, right, for all of these defendants? Did they talk about it in the context of January 6th specifically? Like, did the judges use that day and those terms to kind of flesh out their own thinking?
Yes, they did. Justice Brett Kavanaugh noted that Joseph Fisher himself had been charged under multiple offenses,
which includes civil disorder, physical contact with the victim, assault, entering and remaining in a restricted building, disorderly and disruptive conduct, disorderly conduct in the Capitol building. And why aren't those six counts good enough, just from the Justice Department's perspective, given that they don't have any of the hurdles?
Because those counts don't fully reflect the culpability of petitioner's conduct on January 6th. Those counts do not require that petitioner.
Solicitor General Prelogar noted that those counts don't fully reflect the kind of culpability that Joseph Fisher would have for disrupting and obstructing this official proceeding.
Yeah. Again, it's so wild to me that there isn't some official law that would stop you from storming the Capitol. That in a way, this one's kind of borrowed, right? Like, it's basically covers any official proceeding. So,
but there are other law. Oh, this is what is important to note about this particular
one. Oh, good.
One.
Tell me.
There's a 20-year maximum sentence. So a lot of the other offenses that have been pulled together to charge January 6th defendants might not have a series of penalties. So this is one that, as Jeffrey Green, who was representing Joseph Fisher, noted, that this one really has a lot of muscle behind it.
I'm here with Joan Biskupic talking about the Supreme Court the last couple of days and some of the conversations that will be happening in the court in the next few days. Stay with us.
I'm Dr. Sanjay Gupta, CNN's chief medical correspondent. This week on Chasing Life.
Lately, we have been paying attention to a very different virus, bird flu, which is caused by the H5N1 virus. If you start to hear that it's circulating in pigs, that would be a concern.
That means I would go from sleeping with one eye open to one and a half eyes open. Yeah, that would make me very concerned.
Listen to Chasing Life, wherever you get your podcasts.
So I'm back here with Joan Biskupic. We're talking about the Supreme Court and January 6th. And so the one thing I haven't heard yet is Jack Smith and whether or not this affects anything he's working on in terms of investigating January 6th.
Okay. Jack Smith is a special counsel who has charged Donald Trump with four counts related to election subversion. That case is going to be heard April 25th. The way Jack Smith is shadowing this case is that two of the counts against Donald Trump involve this law, testing the obstruction of an official proceeding. Jack Smith did not submit any kind of filing in this case involving Joseph Fisher, but what he did in his immunity case to be heard on April 25th is drop a footnote in those filings saying, we're aware that the court is also hearing the case of Fisher versus United States. We're aware that there's controversy over the use of that law, but no matter how the court rules, either for the United States or for Joseph Fisher, the charges that we, the federal government, with Special Counsel Jack Smith, have filed against Donald Trump would still be valid. And the reason he says that is, if you find that you don't need any kind of evidence tampering, we're covered completely because he obstructed an official proceeding. If you do find there needs to be some element of evidence tampering or destruction, we're covered there too. Because Donald Trump, according to Jack Smith, actually did try to taint and tamper with actual election documents arising from the electoral count.
I see. So he's saying, like, look, I've looked at this all the different ways, and I think we would be covered regardless.
Exactly. And just so you know, Audie, Donald Trump's name did not come up once during the arguments in the Fisher case.
All right. So let's talk about this other case that's coming up, which is the question of whether Donald Trump can claim presidential immunity from prosecution. That's another whole conversation that's happening. When is it happening and what is the debate there?
Okay. This case is much broader and it directly affects former President Trump. The question is, can a former president be absolutely immune from criminal liability for his actions while in office? That's a completely untested question. The Supreme Court in the past has said that a president can be immune from civil claims once he leaves office, but has never taken on the question of criminal liability. And what the government says is that's a weightier context because we're talking about criminal laws where much more is at stake. And in this situation, it involves election subversion. It involves a former president who actually tried to prevent the peaceful transfer of power.
So in a way, even though there are 91 counts of various charges of various kinds against Donald Trump in cases in different states, the question you're asking now is the one we all actually want to know the answer to, which is, can you charge him at all?
In a federal context, yes. And what he's claiming is that he's absolutely immune. And this is another one where lower court judges have already weighed in. And in this situation, every lower court judge who has weighed in, the district court judge and the three-judge panel of the D.C. Circuit, have all said absolutely not to Donald Trump. Whatever immunity he had when he was president, it dissolved once he left office and became Citizen Trump. And the other thing,
but obviously there's still a question, right? If it got all the way to the Supreme Court.
Yes, because as I said, the Supreme Court has never directly said whether a president would be absolutely immune or not. I think, frankly, this is the one of the three cases that are pending against that involved Donald Trump where he could lose. He didn't lose in the Colorado one. And as we discussed in the one involving Joseph Fisher, the justices were very skeptical about the government's argument that that obstruction of official proceeding law could be used so broadly.
You know, we were in doing research for this. There was an op-ed in The Washington Post. It was written by a man named Jason Willick. And he was criticizing Jack Smith. And he said that basically Trump is being charged for his official acts as president rather than as a private citizen, and that that somehow was a mistake. Can you talk about why people are trying to parse out that president versus private citizen?
Well, we'll see if it makes any difference to the justices. When they agreed to hear this case, they did write into the question that they would be looking at whether immunity attaches to a former president in the context of alleged official acts. So there is a small chance, Audie, that this could go back to lower courts to, you know, separate official versus personal acts. But I think what Jack Smith was trying to do in the original charges was to say what he did in whatever capacity was so criminal that he couldn't possibly have immunity for it. In fact, what Jack Smith says in his written filing, and as will be argued on Thursday, I'm sure, is that if there's some place for a president to have, a former president to have some immunity, for example, over issues of foreign affairs where he might have had some reason.
Right, where you're commander in chief.
Yes, some reason to do something that could later be seen as
criminal.
Yes. Whatever immunity might exist, if there's any shred left, it would not apply here. This was election subversion, and in no way should the Supreme Court endorse that. So I think that the question over what kind of acts these were, whether official or personal, will probably turn out to be irrelevant. And the main thing was when he went through all the different charges, including obstruction of an official proceeding and interference with the right to vote and other fraudulent efforts that he's alleging the former president had made, that they would all give rise to criminal liability and that the former president could not claim he's immune from that.
What I'm hearing is that these cases before the Supreme Court are far more consequential and far more kind of, I don't know, relevant to the questions we've all had since January 6th than what's happening now in Manhattan.
I think that's right. I think we're focused so much on Manhattan right now because, first of all,
Which is fundamentally about falsifying business records and hush money, et cetera. But that the DA there is trying to say is election interference because it was happening before the 2016 election. But what we've just been talking about, like, feels far more consequential.
Well, it was so big. Just think, you know, almost everyone who's hearing this, if they think back to what they saw on January 6th on their TVs or what they heard through the radio or what they read the next morning, that was so big.
And we all felt like, how is this happening? Like, I just felt a kind of shock of like, wait a second, am I seeing this? And you left feeling like, well, something's going to happen. Someone's going to get in trouble for this, right? And people have, but these court cases reveal that there are still some questions we have as a country, right? That there's not really, we're not sure, how do you punish what we saw?
That's the perfect way to state it, because what we saw certainly should have been punished. I think that everybody would agree that if you break into the United States Capitol and you engage in wrongdoing of some sort, something must cover it. And many laws do. The question is, though, as we started with the Fisher case, should that particular law, that particular 2002 law written in the wake of the Enron scandal, should that be used? So that's a very legitimate question. And then when you talk about the immunity case that we're discussing now, it is an untested major constitutional question. So the justices, it is important for the justices to resolve it. The justices had a chance to take this case last December when special counsel Jack Smith went to the justices and said, Donald Trump is claiming absolute immunity. Lower courts have certainly, at that point, the D.C. Circuit hadn't ruled, but have cast doubt on this. Take it. Please take it up. Please take it up now. And the justices didn't. The justices delayed that and essentially single-handedly blew past the early March deadline that had been scheduled for the trial of Donald Trump on these election subversion charges. So you're exactly right. That's really kind of the biggest question that the country's grappling with in the wake of the 2020 election. And what's happening in Manhattan goes all the way back to the 2016 election. But the reason there's so much focus on it is because in its own way, it's very unprecedented to have a former president sitting in a courtroom. And when you're on trial, that's when you do indeed go to the courtroom and have to sit in the courtroom while you're on trial. And there he is having to hear all this testimony about what he did.
In this case, the jurors also just saying what they think of him, right?
As they're exactly.
Jury selection. Exactly. He's like forced to be in that chair.
Right. And the venue of the Supreme Court is much more distilled. You know, it's a smaller place, no jurors, 9 justices. They will not be hearing testimony. They hear from just 2 lawyers. They will hear on Thursday from Donald Trump's lawyer, who's argued below for him, and from a representative of Jack Smith. It will be Michael Dreeben, a longtime advocate before the Supreme Court, who will be arguing on behalf of Jack Smith. It won't be Jack Smith himself.
Trump has made so much of getting his nominees onto the court and refers to them as my justices. Do we have a sense of what they think about this question of immunity?
Let me take your broader question about Trump's justices, in air quotes, which he does act like this court is his. He definitely acts that way. And I think what has happened, what I've observed over time with this court since his appointees have come on, is that certainly we have seen plenty of sympathy for Donald Trump. Justice Clarence Thomas has been an enthusiastic supporter of Donald Trump in various ways. But at the same time, this court, under Chief Justice John Roberts, has also tried to create some distance with this very polarizing figure of Donald Trump. So I think it cuts both ways, just kind of in the broader question of how they regard Donald Trump. But in terms of presidential immunity and presidential powers, if they're going by their precedent and constitutional history, I would think they will rule that Donald Trump is not absolutely immune.
Because it's a bigger question about what are the powers of a president.
Exactly right. And also the accountability. It's an accountability question. But We do have several members of the current Supreme Court, including Chief Justice John Roberts, who have tried to provide more authority, more power to the president. But in this case, because it has more to do with accountability, and former President Trump is asking for so much, he's asking for absolute immunity in every single situation, including, as one justice on the D.C. Circuit Court raised during oral arguments, even if he were to order SEAL Team 6 to assassinate a political rival, he'd still have immunity.
Under his argument.
Exactly. Yeah. So what he wants is so big that I think that he's just asking for a loss here. But who knows? And also, who knows if the justices will rule for the government, but then give Donald Trump a little bit of a lifeline with a remand to lower courts that will bring about even more delay before any kind of trial.
Wait, what? So they could be like, wait a second, we're going to let the lower courts think about this some more?
Iron out the issue of are these official acts or not. Now, I
just groan because it just feels like that's just putting off the conversation again.
I think that's how many people would view it. But in Jack Smith's written filing, he has sort of anticipated that possibility and urged the justices not to go down that road. I actually think if the justices go down that road, that many, many people would think this is just another move that, even though it doesn't say rule in favor of Donald Trump on the bottom line, effectively is favoring Donald Trump because it's giving him much more time to delay, and we'll never have a resolution on these charges before the November 2024 election.
Okay, but for now, it's at least scheduled, so we know the conversation theoretically could start in the coming days.
Correct.
Well, I'm going to put my finger on the scale and say that if you are trying to figure out what you should pay attention to in terms of courtrooms in the next couple of days, I would much rather hit play on the oral arguments for the Supreme Court.
I think that's exactly right. And
as much as people are interested in the hush money case in New York, it just feels like this is the one you want to hear the arguments for. Feels momentous.
That's right. And guess what? They can. At 10 o'clock on Thursday, Eastern Time, people can tune in to hear those. They can hear them. They'll be live streamed. Whereas what's going on in Manhattan right now is not...
It's a lot of sketch drawings.
Exactly.
Right?
You can't hear it. And people know just through notes from insiders being sent out to reporters on the air. But this one, you, Audie, will be able to listen to and draw your own conclusions over who has the better argument and where the justices are coming from.
Joan, thank you so much. I love the enthusiasm you bring to this extremely confusing world.
It's a lot of fun.
Unsettled case law.
And your questions are great. And these are the kinds of questions that the justices are grappling with themselves.
Well, I look forward to looking for you out in the scrums on the front steps. Thanks so much.
Thank you, Audie.
Joan Biskupic is senior Supreme Court analyst here at CNN. Her book is called Nine Black Robes: Inside the Supreme Court's Drive to the Right and Its Historic Consequences. That's out now in paperback. That's all for today's episode of The Assignment. The Assignment is a production of CNN Audio, and this show was produced by Dan Bloom. Matt Martinez is our senior producer, and the executive producer of CNN Audio is Steve Lickteig. We got support from Haley Thomas, Alex Manisseri, Robert Mathers, John Dianora, Lenny Steinhardt, Jameis Andrus, Nicole Pesseru, and Lisa Namorow. Thanks, as always, to Katie Hinman. I'm Audie Cornish. Thank you for listening.
Quality sleep is essential, and that's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. So you can choose what's right for you whenever you like. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature. Quiets their snores. Sleep Number does that. Sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on Sleep Number limited edition smart beds for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.